Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been waiting all day to get to this point because, you know, yesterday we talked about this this Stephen Calabrese guy who was the co-founder of the, or is the co-founder of the Federalist Society, a guy who, as I said yesterday, he's the guy behind the curtain. He's the guy, he's really the puppet master in a lot of this. And for him to come forth and say that Donald Trump should be impeached immediately and that his just tweeting the idea of moving the election is fascistic is a really big deal. So I've been waiting for my good friend Bob Ney to come give us some thoughts. Bob spent an enormous amount of time in Congress, knows these people and the background, and I think knows how big this moment is. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So, you know, am I overstating this? I mean, I see this guy as, you know, the figure behind the curtain. He's the guy who's got his hand in a lot of stuff. For him to come out and have his name known, this is a big, to steal a Biden frame, this is a big effing deal.
Oh, it is. And, you know, you're not overstating it. People who are supporting President Trump but really don't know some of the guts around the country or the insides of things, they're understating it. Just to give you an example, in January of 2019, all right, the Washington Post magazine wrote that the Federalist Society had reached an, quote, unprecedented peak of power and influence. Of the nine members of the Supreme Court of the United States, right, five of those nine members are former members of, guess what, the Federalist Society. So this is one of these groups that, you know, somebody may sit there and say, well, I don't know who they are. They are really... they permeate around the country of conservative and libertarian opinion.
Yeah.
And so, and what shocked me the most on this is the words he used. He didn't just come out and say, hey, you know, that's really not a cool thing you're doing, or, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you saying that? He used the word fascist.
No, I mean, and twice, not just once, but twice.
Right. So when I saw that, I about flipped.
He went and he said, no, I thought the Democrats were being hyperbolic. They're not. And this is one of those moments where, I've been waiting for this. And I think a lot of us have. I mean, I think we've been watching Mitch McConnell try and distance the Senate from Trump and right. Some people trying to move away. This seems to me like the shot heard around the boardroom. This sounds like the shot that's going to go. It's now open season.
Well, it is, because the people belonging to this, the Federalist Society, are considered constitutional purists. And so anybody that goes into that category, and I don't care if it's Donald Trump, I don't care if Ronald Reagan had said that, right? These are people who will react exactly the way he has. But again, he came out so tough that for me, being around D.C., being around this whole system, it took my breath away when I saw it, because if I was President Trump's campaign manager, I would be, I don't know what I'd be doing, probably on the phone begging for mercy.
I'd be looking for another job, actually.
Well, that too, yes.
Because to me now, this is, and maybe it's just me having watched this stuff play out for so long and you know, kind of getting what the background game is, and maybe not, you know, fully understanding the cult of Trump. But, you know, like I said, I think this is like the dagger. Do you think it's going to matter to the base? Do you think they'll get the magnitude of this kind of a statement?
Well, if you take everything, every piece that's happening now, Mitch McConnell signaling, as you said, to the senators, hey, you know, if you have to go after the president, go after him, which, you know, to signal that, it's quite amazing in itself. The coronavirus, the social upheaval. If you take pieces of this, the never Trumpers, yeah, and people say, well, they were out there last time. Well, that's okay. This is a whole different world this time. You take that piece, then you add this. This is just enough people that are within the base that are going to be unhappy that it causes a definite severe heartburn for the Trump campaign. Severe. Yeah. This one is probably one of the most underrated stories that I've seen by a lot of people that are you know, out there, and they're not really attuned to the political system. But if they really knew this Federalist Society and its large reach around this country, I mean, it's enough that, hey, if you know, 5% move because of this, that's a big number.
And the other question that I come back with, you know, as you've said, their tentacles reach into, you know, virtually every sect of conservative policy, into all of the think tanks. I mean, they're right at the top of the respect list in that really incredible infrastructure that the conservatives have built. How much of this then turns around and the moneyed interests start to dry up, where they're going, well, the Federalist Society's bailed on them, we're going to stop blowing money on this?
Well, right. If you just look at, they have a lawyer division of this, right? There are 70,000 practicing attorneys, right, in 90 cities, and they are members of the Federalist Society. I mean, I can go on and on about the subgroups, the methods, how they do influence. And just to share a quick personal story, you know, you know where I'm from. I'm from Appalachia, Ohio. I had a 14-15% Republican index in my district. I knew people and I knew things, but I didn't know groups because I function on my own with right. That kind of index, right? And I got to D.C. and I'm sort of like, oh well, the Federalist Society, and you get grabbed by the collar out there, and they, oh no, it's not, oh yeah, the Federalist, it's the Federalist Society. Next thing you know, they're quoted constantly. They're giving endorsements of who's going to be on courts in the federal court system. They have a whole judicial, you know, philosophy. And they are active members, all included, by the way, National Federation of Independent Business. They've supported them, you know. So, yeah, you quickly learn this is a group that you may not know its name. You may not know who's running it, but they just have one of these very powerful, kind of almost semi-silent fingers that run through the whole thread around the United States.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of these kind of groups. I mean, you look at, sure, you know, C Street, for instance. I mean, they're another one, right, who, you know, outweighed, you know, just incredible amount of influence that you don't even know who they are. And and again, there's part of me that goes, maybe this is a good moment to educate on just, you know, how some of these groups operate and how much power they actually have, and, you know, how much we've given away to their secret power.
Right. And, you know, people well, Grover Norquist, who is he? Well, he's got an anti-tax group, and that's been out there very powerful years. I mean, we can keep going down lists of people that, again, the general public may not know them, but they have such ability to, you know, follow policy and make it run through the way they want in Washington, D.C., and this group's one of them.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, though. I mean, because, you know, I brought it up last night to a friend, and he goes, you know, what's the big deal? You know, Trump, he's just poking the bear. You know, what's the big deal? He wasn't serious. He was just poking the bear. He knows he can't delay the election. He knows he can't move the election. And my response is, are you sure that he knows that?
Well, it rises to the level when you read what he said in your mind that this might be a possibility he's thinking about, because, you know, nobody tinkers with moving an election. It was done in Ohio by the former head of the Department of Health. She moved the election. That went down like a whole barrel of rocks. You don't do that. Now, in this case, it's almost like, let's take it to another step. It's like postponing an election, not moving it, but postponing it. You don't even hint about that. You don't even joke about it. You don't throw that out to see what people would think. I think it was a huge error. And when I saw it, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. That is a line in the sand that no one in this country crosses. We have elections. Nothing stops elections.
And that's one of those things where, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, I'm hoping this is that moment where, you know, across party lines, that you go, this is just that line you don't cross. Because, you know, when I was talking about Calabresi's statement, I'm going, you know, this is for them. I mean, this is their holy sacred line. And I give them credit in this moment for stepping forward and saying, yeah, this is the line. This is the glaring red line in the sand that we're just never going to allow to happen. And I'm hoping as a country, we kind of come around to that, because what's weird is some of the responses I got from people going, well, you know, maybe, you know, the pandemic, you know, the mail-in voting stuff, we're not so sure about. It just seems like, you know, we're in this kind of squishy moment where some of us, I guess, as a country are a little more pliable.
Well, and Republican leaders came out condemning this right away and saying that's not going to happen, because the one thing you don't have in our democracy, our republic, whichever which you want to say, is one person saying we're not going to have an election, because then that becomes a whole different type of government.
Right.
If one person does that, and that's why no one has the ability to say that. And also, no one has the ability to speculate on, well, what the election is going to be like in November. We don't know what it'll be like in November, but it will be there.
Right.
That we know.
But here's the other thing, and this is where, you know, I think we talked about this a while ago. I remember on election night, you know, 2016, I was at the Democratic Party headquarters watching results, and there was a guy there who, you know, he runs campaigns. He has no ideology. He has no real belief system. For him, it's about the game. And you know people like this. It's just about, you know, it's just about moving the pieces on a chessboard. And, you know, he's one of those guys, you know, he gives you insight that maybe you wouldn't have thought about. And he said it was on that night, as, you know, Trump was being, you know, they were saying he was going to win. He was going, it's going to be interesting watching liberals become states' rights people. When Trump does all the things that we know he's going to do. And it has been over the last couple of years interesting to watch that happen. And this is one of those things. The president can't just move the date because, as I understand, you know, Election Day is in a lot of state constitutions. You just can't usurp the state's constitutions.
Correct. I mean, it's there. It's set. We can't do this. We have a constitutional provisions of the presidency. So, again, even to suggest a question mark of, you know, I think he was trying to say something that doesn't even apply or make sense, but he was trying to say, well, don't you want a fair election? So, you know, wouldn't it be okay to move something for 3 more months? No, it's not.
No.
It's not good to imply it, not good. Was bad policy, and he should never have done it.
Yeah, and he's going to take a beating for it. But here's the thing: the Democrats aren't going to move on the impeachment thing, as the guy said. Go ahead and do. They've already got his endorsement. But here's the thing: here's the weird thing. Congress's approval rating has tanked again. The Democrats taking a major hit, and again, I'm not quite sure why. They've done everything they could possibly do to give this president the opportunity to deal with this virus. They've said, here, take as much money as you need, open the purse, spend. They just won't do it.
You know, Congress had went up, and it hit a 20-year high in April and May, which is, you know, pretty good for Congress. And the congressional approval in July was down at least 10 points across the board. And the approval from Democrats fell the most. They went from 39% to 20%. Republicans dropped from 24%, so they were below. They're in worse shape. They're to 14%. But I was surprised at the Democratic side going down to 20. I'm not sure why, unless there's just an overall opinion of, you know, Congress is just not doing its job. Now, this is one thought I do have, Rick. The Senate has failed to come up with a very important bill for the coronavirus and the unemployment. Very, you know, it's important. And one thing I do know from being out there, we would sometimes vote in the House and the Senate wouldn't move, and I'd go back to the district, and I'd be pretty happy. Hey, we took a position, and people would say, I don't care, it's not passing. Well, don't blame me, I'm not in the Senate. I don't care, I'm angry. So possibly the frustration, frankly, with the Senate may also have filtered over just to the whole system.
No, and that's, you know, there's part of me that goes, you know, Mitch McConnell is such a gamesman and such a master at this that I don't doubt that this is part of it. Tank the whole system while you can, because your ship's going down. This is that scorched earth that I've been talking about for a while. Because why else would you bail for a long weekend? On the weekend where you've got the unemployment cliff, on a weekend where the first of the month is going to hit and millions of people aren't going to be able to pay their rent, why would you choose? I mean, just from the optics of it, even if you're not going to get anything done, you stay there, you get your, you look like you're working, but to take a long weekend, come on.
On big issues, and you're 100% right, on big issues, I mean, I've heard this said in D.C. over and over, we're going to do something even if it's wrong. We're going to do something. You make your stake. You make your claim. And the Senate could have done that. If Mitch McConnell wanted to make it happen, he would have made it happen. And they would have passed a bill and then said, okay, it's between the House and Senate now. We do a conference committee, et cetera, et cetera. And then he could actually, you know, they could share kind of a little bit of the blame together. But he didn't do that. And so now everybody just gets angry and they're mad at the whole system. I mean, you know how it is. If you're desperate, you want your unemployment check. Even though the House has moved, you think to your congressman, why can't you go over there and browbeat the two senators in the state you're in? You know, why can't you make them do that? Why can't you be their boss? Well, you can't be. So the whole system gets angry. And maybe that's what McConnell wanted.
No, it's all I can think of because, look, you know, I know people who, you know, they're struggling, man. The unemployment system in this state and other states across the country are still overloaded. You can't get an email answered. You can't. Good luck getting on the phone with anybody because it is just so jammed up and so backlogged. And yet, you know, we got the Senate going to take a long weekend, going to go golfing.
Exactly.
It's just crazy and sad on so many levels because, look, I mean, with that extra $600, I think is what saved us from massive calamity. Now, we've had the biggest contraction of our economy in the history of our country. And you could say, well, you know, that was part of the pandemic and it was all this stuff. But it was the response to it that didn't make it much, much worse. I mean, we're going to make if we do nothing now, we're going to make it much worse.
Oh, exactly. They have to do something. People are really hurting.
Crazy. No doubt. Lastly, I wanted to get your thoughts on yesterday's. Yesterday was really a bizarre day. I mean, you know, you had President Obama and the funeral of John Lewis, which to me was an amazing moment. I want to get your thoughts on that. But you also had, Trump's press conference, all of the insanity of we're going to move the election, and then the passing of Herman Cain, and then the fight over what he died from. It just seemed like such a bipolar day yesterday, really just a magnification of the two Americas that we have become.
Well, it was. Of course, John Lewis, I just really admired John Lewis, but I watched that, and of course, President Obama really rose to the day, you know. But you also had George Bush there and Bill Clinton, and it was, you know, three presidents, three former, coming together to, you know, at least have some joint time of healing together. I thought it was an amazing moment. I really did.
Should Trump have been there?
Well, on that one, I would say not going probably was okay because if he went, it would have been bad.
Yeah.
If he didn't go, it's bad. So probably choosing not to go was the best thing versus him going there. And obviously he couldn't have spoken.
Oh, absolutely not.
Or couldn't have spoken. Let's face it, you know.
Because I think that would have, if you've ever seen anyone rise from the dead, I think John Lewis would have come back from the dead at that point.
And John, he was such a wonderful guy. Yeah, to have that happen, I'm not sure that the Secret Service wouldn't have had to step in the church at one point in time. So, not good.
But, you know, just the fact that, you know, you saw nothing out of Trump on this, you know, even to say, I don't know, it's crazy.
He did the half-mast with the flags and things, but, you didn't see much more out of him at all. But, of course, look, when McCain died, I mean, probably, in fact, I think when McCain died, he didn't want to put the flags at half-mast. At least he did do that automatically this time.
Yeah, and I'm still waiting for him to take credit for allowing him to be laid in state like that, as he did with McCain. He tried to take credit for it.
Yeah, the House and Senate do that. I did the resolution with John Larson, congressman from Connecticut, for Ronald Reagan. The House administration does it. When I saw that before, he took credit. Now, he doesn't have any say in that one. Yeah. That's the House and Senate.
Last thing I got for you. Evidently, there's some dust up. Not everything's... While things are not well in Republican land, not everything's peachy keen in the land of the Democrats either. Evidently, there's some skirmishes going on between the Biden and the Bernie people.
Right. Look, Nina Turner is an Ohioan, and she's a former political person, and she's a professor from Ohio, right? Former state senator. Nina Turner's a big deal, and I spoke to her at the Democratic convention 4 years ago, so... Nina Turner, her quote. Here was her quote. It was not only disturbing but disrespectful. Now, Nina Turner is Sanders' former campaign co-chair, and she said, disgusting, disturbing, and unacceptable. Now, was she talking about Donald Trump? No. She was talking about Joe Biden's people, is what she was talking about. Because a spat occurred when Brent Welder, a Sanders appointee, this is the convention rules for the Democrat National Committee, right, for the convention. He proposed a resolution falling in line with Bernie to change the party charter to refuse all corporate PAC dollars and to limit corporate lobbyists from serving on the Democrat National Committee for several years. And the Biden appointee called for it to be tabled, and they caught them kind of off guard because they said, Sanders people said, tabled until when? And then they said, this is the day, is the Biden people, you're acting like children. And that kind of set Nina Turner off.
Ouch.
Yeah. And so, look, Biden's people have to learn that this isn't over with. Don't take victory and kind of toss it down the street and make it roll around a little bit. You know, he's ahead. He needs Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and a lot of other people. And Biden needs a progressive. So, yeah, this was a move where it would have been just better to leave out the you're acting like children line, referring to Nina Turner and Sanders people. So it's a little hiccup, but they just need to be a little bit softer, Biden's people.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, maybe not a bad idea. Maybe just right. Lighten up a little bit, because you're right. I mean, I hate to see him at the last minute snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory.
Well, right, because, look, people say, well, this is kind of trite. Well, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to the Sanders people.
Yep.
He's not their nominee. Elizabeth Warren's not. They want a few concessions here and there. But if the Biden people don't want to change the party platform, then just be more gracious about it. Get through the convention. Have a harmonious convention, not one where you fight each other.
That's it.
Right.
Don't cause any more problems than you
right.
need. You got
exactly.
enough already. Anyway, Bob, I appreciate the time. As
Thank
always,
you,
great stuff.
You too. Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney, former congressman, political analyst. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.